Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Australian RCVS and European Veterinary Specialist in Oncology, Dr. Shasta Lynch. Thank you, Shasta. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for joining me for this webinar today. We're going to cover quite a lot in the next hour, starting with conventional chemotherapy, what it is, when it's indicated, what can go wrong, how we minimize complications and what kind of complications can develop, particularly what are the pitfalls where the things that we may miss and mistakes that get made fairly regularly. We'll then move on to other types of chemotherapy, so metronomic chemotherapy, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and that will cover all of the chemotherapy agents that you're likely to come across in general practice. And we'll move on finally to the physical administration of these chemotherapy drugs with a focus on health and safety so that you can be sure when you're administering the drugs that you're doing it as safely as possible and following best practice guidelines. So I'll start with conventional chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is being used more and more often in veterinary cancer treatment as it becomes more accessible and as pets are living longer and getting cancer more, and as owners are expecting treatments that are more advanced to be available for their pets, including in general practice. It can be defined as cytotoxic anti-cancer treatment, so it's treatment that kills cancer cells, and it encompasses a wide variety of different drugs. Many of them are injectable and some of them are oral medications, and they are virtually all human medications that we have adapted for use in veterinary medicine. And different drugs have different mechanisms of action and different indications for different cancers and need to be used with care depending on the species. Conventional chemotherapy targets dividing cells by interfering with processes that are involved in progression through the cell cycle. So the cell cycle is how every cell in the body is dividing all the time, depending on where the cell is located. And the cells move through the G1, S, G2, and then mitosis phase of the cell cycle, with a period of rest where many cells in the body will actually be in the rest phase, and then they'll move back into the cell cycle at the time that they need to. And chemotherapy drugs interfere with this cell cycle so that the cells can't replicate and divide and grow, and so that the cancer cells reduce in number rather than increase in number. And the reason that chemotherapy that targets the cell cycle works for treating cancer is that tumor cells are very rapidly dividing. So that cancer cells of most cancer types will divide much more quickly than most of our normal cells in our body. And so by targeting the cell division, we can preferentially kill more cancer cells than the damage that we cause to other cells in the body. There will, though, however, always be some damage to normal cells, and that really is what limits the amount of the drugs that we can give and also the types of the drugs that we can give. And it will be our rapidly dividing or the patient's rapidly dividing cells that are in their normal tissues that where we see the side effects. So conventionally, we give chemotherapy at the maximum tolerated dose, so we give the highest amount of the drug that can be administered without causing unacceptable side effects. So we try and kill as many cancer cells as possible, but we don't give so much drug that we also kill so many normal cells that the patient becomes very unwell. We then need to give the patient a break so that those normal tissues that are damaged as that are the collateral damage and a byproduct of trying to kill the cancer cells can have a break to repair and to return to normal, so that, for example, the gastrointestinal lining will be damaged by chemotherapy, and then during the break period, those cells can replenish and new cells will form and replace the damaged gastrointestinal tract lining. And so that means that if there are clinical signs related to the damaged normal cells, that they will disappear during the break period after the new cells develop. The breaks are really important for quality of life, particularly in veterinary patients, but without the breaks between treatment, chemotherapy would, you know, have a high chance of being, well, it could be potentially fatal if you continue to give the chemotherapy without the break to let the normal tissues recover. But it is when during those break periods that the cancer cells are able to also regrow. And so chemotherapy protocols are designed to balance quite finely the fact that we need to preferentially kill the cancer cells, but we'll also kill the normal cells, and we need to allow the normal cells enough break to repair, but not allow the cancer cells enough break to regrow completely. So it's based on the fact that the biology of cancer cells and normal cells is a little bit different, and also the protocols are fairly carefully designed. Chemotherapy is only indicated in dogs and cats with cancer where there is a firm diagnosis. So we never give chemotherapy when there's a suspicion of cancer, but it's not clear. We always do everything within our power to obtain a diagnosis. And the firm diagnosis in many cases will require histopathology, but there are some cancers like lymphoma where we can get a firm diagnosis from cytology or possibly from flow cytometry as well. So it depends on the specific cancer what tests are needed to get the firm diagnosis, but it's critical that the diagnosis is confirmed before chemotherapy is administered. And that's because chemotherapy is not a gentle treatment, and the risks outweigh the benefit if the cancer diagnosis isn't confirmed. Chemotherapy is given as the sole treatment for some tumor types, such as lymphoma, leukemia, multiple myeloma. So these are cancer types where the cancer is throughout the body. So the treatment needs to get into the bloodstream and also travel throughout the body. It's also given in combination with surgery and or radiation therapy for tumor types that have a high metastatic rate. So a tumor may require adequate local control. So a surgery to remove a mass, or radiation therapy to shrink a mass, or surgery combined with radiation therapy to remove a mass and then mop up any cells that are left behind. And if that tumor type has a high metastatic rate, then chemotherapy will be given systemically to try and kill the microscopic cancer cells which may be circulating or have already formed microscopic metastatic disease elsewhere in the body, distant from that primary site. Chemotherapy is also used as a palliative treatment. So a number of patients that I see will have a cancer that isn't amenable to surgery, or where the owner has declined an aggressive surgery, and they may instead prefer to have some medical treatment that prolongs good quality life rather than having a more intensive treatment. The chemotherapy agents that you're most likely to see in practice include cyclophosphamide, vincristine, doxorubicin, chlorambucil, lamustine, vinblastine, and carboplatin. And we tend to use these drugs in different combinations and depending on the species and the tumor type. Side effects related to conventionally administered chemotherapy tend to primarily affect the intestinal tract, the bone marrow, also hair follicles. So these are areas in the body where there are a large number of rapidly dividing cells. Most dogs aren't going to experience significant side effects, and that's because we give chemotherapy in such a different way in veterinary patients compared to how people receive chemotherapy. Humans receive chemotherapy as a result of a decision that they've made for themselves, and so they're given their treatment in a very aggressive way with the understanding that they accept the side effects and would choose length of life over quality of life. And for the majority of people, whereas our veterinary patients can't make that decision for themselves. And so we need instead to prioritize their quality of life. And so it's very important that we ensure that our veterinary patients have a normal life while they're on chemotherapy. And for my patients, if they do experience any side effects, I never repeat the same treatment, knowing that it will cause the same side effects. I always adjust the treatment, change the drugs, or adjust the doses. Or give treatment breaks, adjust the interval between treatment. There's all sorts of tweaks that can be done to maintain good quality of life, because otherwise it's difficult to justify really for the patient. For those dogs that do develop side effects, or cats, about 25% of the patients that receive chemotherapy will get mild side effects, and that's really dogs. Cats actually get less side effects than dogs, or they show less signs of having side effects compared to dogs. Only about 5% of patients that receive chemotherapy will have side effects that are so significant that they require hospitalization. So that might be severe vomiting, which is very uncommon but occasionally happens, which could require IV fluids and antiemetics. And of course, the treatment wouldn't be continued if we, in the same way, if, because we wouldn't want that to happen again. That can really impact quality of life. And the other reason for hospitalization is, and it's probably more common than severe gastrointestinal side effects, is neutropenia. So the bone marrow, the rapidly dividing cells in the bone marrow, are also affected by chemotherapy. And the most commonly affected cell, and the cell that's affected most quickly, is the neutrophils. And it's not that uncommon for dogs to, or cats to, get neutropenia, but it's quite uncommon for them to require hospitalization. And certainly it's very uncommon for them to die as a result of their chemotherapy. Potential causes of death that are rare but are related to chemotherapy, the most would be, well, most commonly would be the cause would be sepsis. And if a patient is monitored very closely by their owners and they're having regular blood tests, then that is extremely uncommon. And the other possibility is that there could be an unexpected or allergic reaction to a chemotherapy agent, which in this is very, very rare, in the same way that allergic reactions to all drugs are rare. Acute tumor lysis syndrome, is when a large number of tumor cells, usually lymphoma cells, are killed by chemotherapy very rapidly. And that can potentially cause death, but it's something I've only seen once, and so it's very, very rare. So, for when I'm speaking to pet owners about chemotherapy, I advise them that nearly all dogs and nearly all cats, even more cats, will coast through their chemotherapy as normal. Some will have an off day or an off day or two, but that will make adjustments so that that doesn't continue. Other complications related to chemotherapy depend on the type of drug that's being given. Extravasation is a problem for almost all of the chemotherapy drugs that are given IV if they're not given via a clean stick IV catheter and they extravasate. Then there can be very severe burns in the area where the drug is given, and sometimes, particularly with doxorubicin, they can form a non-healing wound, which can even be life-limiting. Vincristine and vinblastine, the wound can take a really long time, months to heal, but does generally heal. And extravasation is very uncommon when a lot of care is taken and when the patient is still and calm. And that may require sedation because a lot of patients aren't still or calm. And I always talk to owners about managing the risk of extravasation, and my preference is for sedation as opposed to carrying any risk of extravasation that's unnecessary. Drug-specific side effects depend on, of course, the drug that's being given. So cyclophosphamide is uncommonly, but it does happen, associated with sterile hemorrhagic cystitis. It's uncommon when furosemide is given alongside the cyclophosphamide, and that's because the sterile hemorrhagic cystitis is caused by the metabolite acrolein that forms from the cyclophosphamide, and that's an irritant to the bladder wall when it sits in the urine inside the urinary bladder. And so if we give furosemide at the same time as giving cyclophosphamide, then that encourages the bladder to be to empty, and the acrolein doesn't sit for as long in the bladder, causing this sterile irritation and inflammation. The other thing that I always suggest to owners when it comes to cyclophosphamide is offering plenty of water and opportunities to urinate during the first 24 hours of treatment, because that's the highest risk period. When sterile hemorrhagic cystitis does occur, it's very difficult to manage, and it's usually a case of supportive therapy while we wait for it to pass. and it can be very uncomfortable for dogs. So prevention is much better, and so furosemide is very important. Hepatotoxicity can potentially occur with a number of drugs, but lomustine is the drug that it's most commonly associated with, and I do see it very common, quite commonly, but taking into consideration that I treat a lot of dogs with lomustine, and they don't all get hepatotoxicity, but I see it quite often as a result of treatment that's been administered over a long period of time, so a number of doses of lomustine. And less often I see it as an early adverse effect just after one or two doses of lomustine. The reason it's important to mention is that the liver enzymes tend to reduce, so it can be life-threatening if it's not picked up and if the treatment's continued. And also, although the liver enzymes reduce when the lomustine is stopped, they need to be detected, the toxicity must be detected early for the patient to still have a chance of a good outcome. So liver enzymes are always monitored for drugs such as lomustine. Allergic reactions are very uncommon, and cardiotoxicity is primarily associated with doxorubicin when it's given, and it's a cumulative toxicity. So there's a couple of things that can be done to reduce the toxicity. One is that the doxorubicin should always be given over 20 to 30 minutes, and the other is that we never give more than a cumulative dose of 180 milligrams per meter squared, because that is associated, exceeding that dose cumulatively, so more than six treatments in a particular patient, is associated with a high risk of developing cardiotoxicity. And cardiotoxicity is generally, it's irreversible, so, and it's a it's a dilated cardiomyopathy effectively, so it's life-limiting. The allergic reactions can occur with any drug, and doxorubicin is one of them where they are reported if the drug's given too quickly. L-asparaginase is another drug. And it's not possible, of course, to go through all of these, but just to raise that there are for each drug, there are specific side effects that are associated with the particular drug, and it is important to know the drug before administering it, which might require just looking up and refreshing prior to starting a protocol. If nausea does develop, and it can develop with any chemotherapy drug, it's important that owners know that the nausea will be self-limiting. It generally occurs day 3, 4, or 5 after chemotherapy if the patient happens to be one of the 25% that develops gastrointestinal signs. And the reason that the nausea is self-limiting is because those cells that are lining the gastrointestinal tract, they will replenish, and there'll be a new layer of cells, a healthy layer of cells not affected by the chemotherapy, by about day 5 or 6 after treatment. And that's just because that's the life cycle of the cells that sit in the gastrointestinal tract. So it won't last forever, but it can occur over those couple of days. Some dogs and cats will benefit from meropenem being administered to prophylactically to prevent, an attempt to prevent nausea following chemotherapy. Certainly for doxorubicin, it does seem to help to reduce the amount and intensity of vomiting if it's given for the 5 days after treatment. And so I tend to prescribe that at least for the first time that that doxorubicin is given. And if the patient doesn't have any gastrointestinal signs, then the next time doxorubicin is given, I'll usually prescribe the meropenem, but suggest to the owner that they don't give it unless they need it, and then they can work out if it's needed or not. And there is literature to support that there's reduced amount and intensity of vomiting, so it's worthwhile prescribing the meropenem prophylactically the first time. The literature hasn't shown that there's a clear benefit in pre-medicating with meropenem when vincristine or cyclophosphamide are administered, or any other chemotherapy drugs. The others haven't been evaluated. So I feel that it's best for owners to have an anti-nausea drug at home to give their pet if needed, but it's hard to justify administering it prophylactically when there isn't the literature to support that it makes a difference unless the drug is doxorubicin. So prescribe it for the owners to have at home, but it doesn't need to be administered for every drug at every treatment. If the patient develops gastrointestinal side effects following chemotherapy, then the next chemotherapy drug should be of the next time the chemo, the same agent is administered. So depending on where the patient is in their chemotherapy cycle, when it comes back to the drug that caused the gastrointestinal side effects, that drug should be dose reduced by 10 to 20% if there were significant gastrointestinal side effects. Very rarely hospitalization is required. Sometimes dogs or cats that are receiving vincristine will benefit from metoclopramide because metoclopramide is occasionally associated with ileus and other peripheral neuropathies. It's not common, but if there is a get reduced gastric motility or reduced intestinal motility or nausea that isn't responding to meropenem, then metoclopramide can often help. Diarrhea is more common with doxorubicin compared to other chemotherapy agents, and some dogs seem to improve with metronidazole. However, they will improve regardless, and the diarrhea will resolve within 3 to 5, well, after it will tends to develop day 3 to 5 after treatment and then resolve after day 5. So it tends to be best managed symptomatically. Hematology should be performed at the expected neutrophil nadir following treatment. So we know that the bone marrow is going to be impacted by chemotherapy and that the cells in the bone marrow that are all dividing, and so they will be damaged and there'll be a gap where there's not enough of those cells. And when that gap occurs depends on the life cycle of the particular cells. So the life cycle of red blood cells is very long. It's 4 to 6 weeks, so we don't see anemia a week after treatment. We can see it months after treatment occasionally, but it's not that common. The life cycle of the neutrophil is about 7 days. So for most drugs that are given as chemotherapy to dogs and cats, the lowest point of so the neutrophil nadir, the lowest neutrophil count will usually be 7 days after chemotherapy. And of course, that's going to vary patient to patient, but in the absence of being able to take blood tests all the time, we tend to aim for 7 days after chemotherapy. We always use the jugular vein, sorry, the jugular vein to take these blood tests, and that's so that we can preserve the peripheral veins for patients that are frequently having IV catheters, so that they don't get too scarred and difficult to place IV catheters in. If the neutrophil count is less than 1 by 10 to the 9, or the patient has a fever, then the next treatment should be dose reduced by 10 to 20%, and the patient treated with broad spectrum antibiotics. And they can be oral antibiotics if the patient doesn't have a fever, but if they have a fever, then IV antibiotics are indicated because the patient is septic and needs aggressive treatment. So if they have a fever and they have neutropenia, that's a medical emergency, and I have owners watching their pet very carefully and calling me if they're at all worried, so that their pet shouldn't be off food and shouldn't be lethargic. And if they are, then the first thing to do is to take hematology and check the neutrophil nadir. And if treatment isn't given very quickly when there's a fever and neutropenia, then that's when we can have unexpected deaths related to chemotherapy. Pet owners often ask me if they should keep their pet separate from other animals because of the risk of developing infections during this period of potential neutropenia. And I always advise them that most dogs and cats won't be significantly neutropenic. So the average dog isn't or cat isn't going to have a neutrophil count of less than 1. Most of them are fine. So from that perspective, it doesn't make sense to separate them from their normal life and and other animals. And also, sepsis tends to develop most likely related to translocation of gastrointestinal bacteria, because chemotherapy patients are uniquely unfortunate in that they have both their bone marrow and their gastrointestinal tract lining damaged at around about the same time. So the bacteria that's already in the patient in the gut can translocate and infect the blood, and if there's not enough neutrophils, that can cause sepsis. So avoiding other animals and pets isn't going to help to reduce the likelihood of sepsis from that perspective. So dosing is very particular and it takes a bit of practice and experience to work out the adjustments to make. So we tend to dose reduce chemotherapy by 10 to 20% if the neutrophils are less than 1 by 10 to the 9 per liter at the nadir hematology, or if they're less than 2 by 10 to the 9 per liter when the chemotherapy is next due. And that's because we don't want to have significant delays in administering chemotherapy. And as oncologists, we will sometimes give chemotherapy and not dose adjust at slightly less than 2 by 10 to the 9 per litre. But that really depends on the specific drug that's being given and how that particular patient is coping with all of their treatments. So it's best if you're not sure, then it's better to dose reduce. And whether we dose reduce by 10 or 20% depends on the level of neutropenia at those particular times. If there are significant gastrointestinal side effects affecting quality of life, then a dose reduction of 10 to 20% can also help to maintain good quality of life. Hair loss is a potential side effect in dogs that have continuously growing hair. This doesn't affect their quality of life because they're not concerned about their appearance, as far as we know, but it can be concerning for owners if they weren't expecting it. So breeds such as poodles, breeds that don't shed, are the ones that have continuously growing hair and are more likely to be impacted by chemotherapy hair loss. I can also see sometimes the loss of whiskers in cats, but it's uncommon, and also guard hairs in terrier breeds that have the long hairs around their nose. They can sometimes become a bit patchy and have less hair, but not lose all their hair. Extravasation is rare if the room is quiet, if the patient's restrained or sedated, and if you only ever place a clean stick IV catheter and check regularly to make sure that it's patent. If extravasation does occur, then it's best to leave the IV catheter in place, to aspirate as much drug as possible, and not to inject any fluid into the IV catheter because we don't want to, if there's any left in the catheter, any of the chemotherapy agent, we don't want to push more of it into the subcutaneous tissues. And from there, the plan depends on the drug that was specifically extravasated, so it's best to call an oncologist because for some drugs we apply heat packs and others we apply cool packs, and occasionally there are drugs that we can give that can help to manage the extent of damage. The lesions can take up to 15 days to develop. So, if a lesion develops in an area where a chemotherapy agent was given in the previous 15 days, then it could be related to an extravasation. And I always record which vein and which limb the chemotherapy agents were given in the patient notes so that I can keep an eye on the patient in case there's an extravasation and know what caused the extravasation. We've mentioned that cyclophosphamide can cause sterile hemorrhagic cystitis and that furosemide markedly reduces the incidence of sterile hemorrhagic cystitis, as does frequent access to water and frequent opportunities to urinate. Regular urinalysis is essential when cyclophosphamide is being administered, and if any microscopic blood is detected on the dipstick or in any aspect of the urinalysis, then the treatment should not be given. And an alternative treatment is given in its place. For example, depending on the protocol, we may use chlorambucil because that doesn't cause any problems with urination. We always check ALT before every lomustine treatment so that we don't worsen hepatotoxicity if it's present. And there is some evidence that giving denormarin alongside lomustine throughout a protocol can potentially help to reduce the severity and the frequency of hepatotoxicity. However, it's not a lot of literature, so if the patient won't happily take denormarin or it's not affordable, or they are big tablets, they can be difficult to give. I don't force it, the issue if it's too challenging, but if it's possible, I have owners give denormarin. As I mentioned, for doxorubicin, giving the drug over 20 to 30 minutes and not exceeding the maximum cumulative dose is important in reducing cardiotoxicity. We also perform echocardiography in any patient that has any signs of cardiac abnormalities or is a breed that is predisposed to dilated cardiomyopathy. And we do that before we give chemotherapy and intermittently during the doxorubicin treatment protocol. So there are some tricks when we're giving chemotherapy, and they make the rules that we've talked about and the guidelines that I've suggested a little bit more challenging. One of those is that the neutrophil nadir isn't always 7 days after chemotherapy. Every patient is going to metabolize drugs in a slightly different way, and we can't account for individual patient variation particularly well because we can't take blood tests regularly enough to detect the nadir for a specific patient if it's not at day seven. Also, there can be variation based on particular drugs, which are a bit more predictable. So what we do see with carboplatin is that the neutrophil nadir tends to be quite delayed. And so a blood test at between day 10 and 14 is better than a blood test at day 7. So I usually check the nadir hematology at day 10. And for cats, I check it at day 14. For lomustine, the neutrophil nadir can be a bit variable as well, and it can be anywhere from 7 to 14 days. I usually check it at day 7, but I'm aware that the dog isn't well after that to check hematology. And in cats, it can be even more delayed, so sometimes it's even up to 4 weeks following treatment. And so the options are either check the hematology weekly and try to catch the nadir, or check it at depending on what's affordable and possible. For the because cats don't like coming to the vet, of course. Either that or check it at day 7 and have the owners monitor very carefully, being aware that the neutrophil nadir could occur later. For melphalan, which is usually given for myeloma-related disorders, and most commonly for multiple myeloma, the neutrophil nadir and the platelet nadir and anemia can all develop quite late. And I tend actually more often to see thrombocytopenia related to melphalan rather than neutropenia or anemia. And that can occur many months after treatment has been started. So even if a patient has been well for 3, 4, 5, or 6 months, I don't ever stop checking their hematology or even stretch it out more than monthly because detecting thrombocytopenia is so important. So, sepsis can be sometimes challenging, and it's an area where very rarely we can get caught up with our oncology patients because most oncology patients will have a fever if they're septic and they'll also be neutropenic. But very rarely, a patient that's very neutropenic will be septic but not pyrexic. And that's because if they don't have enough neutrophil numbers, then they can't mount a fever response. They don't have enough pyrogens. And so the patient will be severely ill and septic, but not actually pyrexic. So if you have a patient that's very neutropenic and they're very unwell, treat them as though they're septic because sepsis is life-threatening, and it's probably the only occasion where you wouldn't ever be wrong if you overtreated with antibiotics. Obviously, in every other aspect, we try to undo to not use antibiotics. More than absolutely necessary, but for a septic patient, you're allowed to use them much more. Sometimes you have to make your best guess about whether a patient is septic, and it would be wrong to not use antibiotics liberally for those patients. So we always treat patients with severe neutropenia with broad-spectrum antibiotics, and as I mentioned, it's usually translocation of gastrointestinal bacteria. Chemotherapy damaging the gastrointestinal tract lining. And so, if a patient is not completely clinically normal and they're neutropenic, then they do need IV antibiotic therapy. If they're neutropenic but they're really well, and then there is an argument for giving them oral therapy, but having them extremely closely monitored at home, and that may include monitoring the temperature if the owner's able to. And that's so that they can switch to IV therapy if they need to, if they don't improve quickly with oral antibiotics. One of the big challenges with chemotherapy, where people can also get caught up, and this is of course the same in human oncology, is when calculating chemotherapy doses and areas that are involved in calculation. So always have two people check a chemotherapy dose, and it's a good idea to use a standard calculation sheet to follow to make sure that everything's been considered. that you've thought about whether you're going to give meropenem or not before treatment. The patient's weight, their lean body weight, their body surface area, and the dose have all been considered, that a clear calculation has been made and that it's been checked by another member of staff. I weigh the patients on the day of treatment, and I always adjust the dose for lean body weight. So I'm mostly weighing them to make sure that they're not losing weight, or I might be concerned if they have a disease that could result in fluid accumulation. That would be a concern from a weight gain perspective. But if they're put on fat, then I don't increase their chemotherapy dose because that could potentially overdose them. They really just need to be dosed for their lean body weight. If they lose weight, then I will reduce the dose in line with their body weight. And if a very overweight patient presents to me, then I will work out what their lean body weight is in order to calculate their chemotherapy dose so that I'm careful not to overdose the patient. And if it's clear that they're not being overdosed and they cope very well, it's easier to increase the dose than to give too much at the start, have a sick patient, and then have both the pet and the owner unwilling to have more treatments, and then the pet's outcomes obviously going to be more poor. Overdosing small patients is another challenge in chemotherapy dose calculation. It seems that when we use body surface area dosing for chemotherapy, that smaller patients get more drug per kilo than larger patients, and that's probably because they have a more rapid metabolism. And because there's probably problems with the formula that we use for calculating body surface area, the formula ignores size independent factors that can influence drug distribution, metabolism, and excretion. So it's not just size that influences how we metabolize and excrete drugs. Of course, there's a number of factors, and most likely the future will involve, certainly for humans and hopefully for veterinary patients, much more patient-by-patient drug dosing, tailoring the correct dose for the particular patient and their metabolism and their genetics. But that's quite a long way off for us. So in the meantime, we adjust some chemotherapy drugs for small patients. So for example, doxorubicin is given at 1 mg/kg instead of 30 mg/m² in patients that are less than 15 kilograms. So it's quite a lot less of the drug, and they tend to cope with that much better. For other drugs where there's a dose range for smaller patients, I'll always start at the bottom of the dose range. And often for larger patients too, I'll start at the bottom end of the dose range and just increase if they're not having problems, rather than starting at the top end and going down. MDR1 mutations can also catch us occasionally, depending, of course, on the particular dog and their breed and whether they have a mutation. It's not common, but it's something just to have in the back of your mind and to test for if you're presented with a particular breed that's predisposed to MDR1 mutations, because many of the chemotherapy drugs, nearly all of them, require the MDR1 gene to metabolize the drugs. So P-glycoprotein is a cell membrane located pump that it acts as a barrier of distribution for drugs. And it has important excretory functions in the gastrointestinal tract, liver, and kidney. And the gene that encodes that protein is called ABCB1 or MDR1. When that gene is mutated, the pump doesn't work properly and too much of the drugs get stuck in the cell. And so the patient suffers from really quite marked toxicity. Most chemotherapy drugs require the P-glycoprotein pump to be excreted. So if you have a patient that has a really severe and unexpected side effects to a chemotherapy agent, it may be related to a mutation, and a blood test can test if that mutation is present. If the patient is homozygous for the MDR1 mutation, they'll have much worse side effects than if they're heterozygous for the mutation. There's a bit more information about this, well, a lot more online, but you can have a look at their list of affected breeds by following this link, or I can guess give you a brief rundown that collies, Australian shepherds, longhead whippets, McNabs, and any of the other breeds that are commonly affected should be tested before treatment. Most of the time it's herding breeds and collies, and they're not the most common breeds to get cancer So it's not a test that you need to be running all the time, but if you have a collie or a herding breed or you have a patient that has unexpected side effects, consider that running this test. If you have a patient that you think might have an MDR1 mutation because of their breed, is a possibility, and you want to start treatment, say a CHOP or a COP protocol, you can start with the drug cyclophosphamide because that's really the only drug in that protocol that doesn't require the MDR1 gene to be normal. And then other drugs we dose reduce depending on whether the patient is heterozygous or homozygous for the mutation. So I don't see any questions there from the first section, so we'll move straight through to other types of chemotherapy. Starting with metronomic chemotherapy, which is continuous low-dose chemotherapy that's given at regular frequent intervals, so usually daily or every other day. And we think that metronomic chemotherapy probably works by inhibiting the blood supply to the tumor, so anti-angiogenic effects, and by positively stimulating the anti-tumor immune response. The dose of chemotherapy that's given for metronomic chemotherapy is very low, so the drugs have to be compounded to a very low dose that's given as then a capsule daily, and they're usually too low to directly kill the cancer cells. And so they're instead trying to impact the tumor microenvironment. And a stable disease or possibly a partial response are a successful treatment. It's generally oral treatment. It's usually cyclophosphamide. It's sometimes chlorambucil, for example, for transitional cell carcinomas of the urinary bladder. Metronomic chlorambucil has been shown to be effective. And it wouldn't make sense to give cyclophosphamide in those patients because if they develop sterile hemorrhagic cystitis, we wouldn't be able to detect it because they already have blood in their urine from their tumor. There's also a small amount of literature describing lomustine, although I don't readily use that. It's usually combined with a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug for anti-angiogenic effects. Compounding pharmacies are required because the drug doses are very small and we can't split or crush chemotherapy tablets. They must be compounded to capsules that have the right dose for the patient. And the same chemotherapy health and safety precautions should be taken with the and when handling the drugs at home because it's the owners that are giving the drugs, and also when handling the excreta. And we'll talk about that soon. So when the indications for metronomic chemotherapy haven't really been clearly established, and there is some literature that suggests that it might be worthwhile considering metronomic chemotherapy for dogs with soft tissue sarcomas that have been incompletely excised and are low grade, but that's really only if all other treatment is declined because it's not the most well, it's not particularly well studied. It's not the most effective treatment when compared to surgery or radiation therapy. For transitional cell carcinomas of the urinary bladder, there are quite a large percentage of dogs that will have a partial response or stable disease, and it can be very effective. And for hemangiosarcoma, was initially some literature that suggested that it may be affected, and intuitively makes sense because of the anti-angiogenic effect and the fact that hemangiosarcomas develop from blood vessels. However, recent literature has questioned whether it works or not, and so really the jury is still out on metronomic chemotherapy, and I tend to reserve it as an option for patients where there's really no other good options and the owners definitely want treatment that's very palliative and that can be administered at home. So the advantages and the reason why, even though we don't have a lot of literature, it's still offered sometimes is that it's so easy to administer. There's no toxicity effectively. It's very, very rare. There's no gastrointestinal side effects. There's hematology is generally normal, as is biochemistry. We check them monthly just in case, hematology and biochemistry, and also urinalysis. But we don't commonly see problems. Furosemide has to be given every time cyclophosphamide is given, so that's going to mean that the chemotherapy drug, the furosemide, and the anti-inflammatory are all going to be given daily, so it's quite a lot of drugs. But if furosemide's given, then sterile hemorrhagic cystitis is uncommon, and if it's not given, it's more common. It's not as expensive as IV chemotherapy, and it's really just offered when other treatments are declined. Tyrosine kinase inhibitors are new drugs, newish drugs that have been developed specifically for our veterinary patients. Tyrosine kinases are enzymes that are involved in signaling pathways that regulate cell survival and proliferation. And in some cancer cells, those signaling pathways will be abnormal or altered. And the TKI will block the abnormal cell signaling pathway. So they're a targeted therapy rather than a traditional chemotherapy. I do see quite a significant amount of side effects, so usually gastrointestinal, usually not severe, and probably 30 to 35% of patients I will see these side effects. Other side effects are uncommon, so problems with the liver, neutropenia, muscle pain, coagulopathies, and other rare side effects don't occur commonly, but we must monitor with hematology, biochemistry, urinalysis, and blood pressure every 4 weeks to make sure that those rare side effects aren't developing. Tesarenib I tend to use for mast cell tumors because it has been shown to be effective. It's possibly effective in other tumors, although the literature is still coming out and it will take a number of years more for us to be clear what tumors it can be useful for. Anal sac adenocarcinoma, thyroid carcinoma, nasal carcinomas, probably other tumors that haven't been yet investigated. The dose that we give is lower than the dose that's written on the prescribing information inside the box, and that's because the studies that have followed the initial studies from when the drug was developed have shown that this lower dose is just as effective and there's a lot less side effects at that dose. Masitinib is also indicated for some dogs with mast cell tumours, so those that have non-resectable intermediate or high-grade mast cell tumours and that really have the c-KIT mutation that's been checked and confirmed. And there is a survival benefit in that specific subset of patients, and the side effects are fairly similar. So we'll move on to make sure that, as there's no questions, we'll make sure that there's time to get through the physical administration of chemotherapy and health and safety. So when I'm administering chemotherapy, I always have an assistant, and I always make sure that my patient is quiet. So that might mean sedation. It certainly means a calm, quiet room with no interruptions. And for dogs, it often means treats. If possible, choose a quiet, low traffic room for chemotherapy administration. Make it free from distractions, easy to clean from a health and safety perspective. Make sure you have a spill kit, which you can purchase a spill kit already containing everything. You don't have to prepare one yourself if you're not sure how to make one. And place a sign on the door so that people know not to interrupt or enter because it's not safe. So clip and aseptically prepare the IV catheter site as you would for any IV catheter placement. And then place a clean stick IV catheter. And I don't tend to use large IV catheters because I want to preserve the vein. So I need to be very careful and treat it delicately. The IV catheter must be a clean stick IV catheter because of the risk of extravasation that we discussed earlier. So if you place the IV catheter and you're not sure if it's patent or clean stick, always remove it and try another leg. And it's better to send the patient home to come back next week or in a few days if you're not sure that the IV catheter can be safely placed. When the chemotherapy drugs are administered, it's important to make sure that you know the drug that you're administering, so know the specific side effects for that drug, so do a little bit of reading beforehand. You need to monitor the patient regularly, so that means before you give the drug, flush with saline, always saline, because some of the drugs will form precipitates with heparin, so always just normal saline. So you place the IV catheter, you connect the tubing, which should be a closed administration system, and draw back to make sure that there's blood in the tubing, and then flush and do that. You can't do that too many times, so do that until you're sure that the IV catheter is patent and that there's no concerns regarding extravasation. The patient themselves needs to be monitored throughout treatment, which usually can be done by the nurse that's assisting you. They can monitor respiratory rate, keep an eye on the patient's demeanor, and check the heart rate through treatment if it's a long treatment. I always use a closed system transfer device. So there's a number of different brands that are available, but Facil and Equishield are two of them. And there's been a number of studies that have been performed that have shown that the products don't significantly complicate the administration of the chemotherapy agents, and they don't make it take longer either. So they really significantly minimize your exposure to chemotherapy drugs, which of course is very important because the chemotherapy drugs are designed to damage cells, and we don't want them to damage our own cells. So they significantly improve safety, and they don't make it more complicated or the treatment to take longer. So definitely worth investing in, and it's a cost that it does increase the cost, but it's a cost that it's reasonable, of course, to pass on to the owners, given that it's essential for chemotherapy administration. And certainly in human hospitals, this is absolutely standard of care. Chemotherapy is never given without a closed system transfer device. So once you've actually administered the drug, and how you administer it will depend, how long it takes to administer it will depend on the drug itself. Drugs such as vincristine will be administered just over a minute or two or three, just slow, depending on the amount of drug, slowly giving a bit of the drug, drawing back, checking that it's still the IV catheter is still patent, and then giving a little more of the drug. Once it's finished, then flushing with saline again. And the drugs that are given over a longer period of time will be drugs such as carboplatin and doxorubicin, which are given over 20 to 30 minutes. Carboplatin can be a bit shorter than that. And those drugs also need to be given with some fluids because they to protect the kidneys and to protect the heart, and it's just the safest way. They can't be given without being diluted. So that when you order the drugs, which it's best to order them from a pharmacy that will provide the drugs for you in a specific in a closed system transfer device at a in a specific prescription by prescription basis for that particular patient, rather than trying to draw up the drugs in the clinic, because unless you have a clean room and a biological safety cabinet, you will absolutely be at high risk of exposing the environment and the staff and the clinic to these potentially cytotoxic drugs. Well, they are cytotoxic, so they could potentially damage your cells. So definitely order the drugs specifically for the patient. Order them in a closed system transfer device so that you don't have to handle the drug at all itself. Be wearing personal protective equipment, so a gown approved for chemotherapy administration, two pairs of gloves approved for chemotherapy, a face mask that is approved for chemotherapy, not a surgical mask, and also eye protection. And don't handle the chemotherapy drugs at all until wearing those personal protective equipment. And then also handle the patients, always wearing that equipment as well. All waste, so once you've removed the IV catheter and placed a bandage on the patient, you'll then have all of the waste products from the chemotherapy, the tubing and the syringes. What I tend to do is place an incontinence pad under the patient in case there is an unexpected spill. And then when I complete chemotherapy, I wrap all of the waste in the incontinence pad and tape it and put it in a Ziploc bag. And then the Ziploc bag goes into a cytotoxic waste container. And there's also sharps containers as well, but we don't tend, I only would dispose of the IV, the catheter itself, and so the sharp part of that, or needles from taking blood tests. I don't actually use needles to draw up the chemotherapy agents in practice myself, because with it, unless there's the correct safety equipment, it's not necessary. So once you've given the treatment and you're sure that the patient has received it all appropriately, you can discharge the patient at the same time. They don't have to stay all day or even for a few hours. If they are being hospitalized because they're unwell or the owners can't collect them immediately, it's very important that their kennel is marked to indicate that cytotoxic drugs have been administered. And that means that anyone that's handling the patient themselves or cleaning their cage or even taking them for a walk should be wearing personal protective equipment. So as I mentioned, that's gloves, powder-free and approved for chemotherapy in two layers. And that's because whether you come in contact with the drug is really related to the thickness that is between your skin and the drug themselves. I tend to place two layers when I'm administering chemotherapy, and then I remove the outer layer once I've removed all of the tubing, so that then I'm handling the patient with the underlayer of gloves that haven't had any contact with any of the chemotherapy tubing or drug or anything like that. The gown must be approved for chemotherapy, so do check the brand that you're using and make sure that it's correct. And that's related to permeability and the thickness of the gowns. A closed system transfer device, a closed administration system is really, really important, and I can't emphasize that enough, that there's no reason that we should be giving chemotherapy in a risky way, because we don't want to expose ourselves or our environment to the drugs, and it would only be cost that would be a good reason to not use it. And I think that it's reasonable for owners to accept that cost, given that it's necessary for safety. Eye protection isn't compulsory, but it's recommended in case there's an unexpected spill. A face shield, again, isn't compulsory, or a respirator mask, but if you're not using a closed administration system, then those things are compulsory because your risk is higher. The effects of exposure to cytotoxic drugs aren't fully understood. So, in the absence of more information, we definitely avoid contact with the drugs. That means we have to be careful not to have skin contact, not to inhale the drugs, not to aerosolize drug, not, and that includes drug metabolites in the urine. So we have to be careful if we're cleaning up accidents with that we don't aerosolize the drug. We shouldn't ingest the drug, so things like, of course, not having any food in the treatment areas, and needle stick injuries as well, but these are needle-free systems, these closed administration systems, so that's less of an issue. If we don't, the greatest risk of exposure for staff administering chemotherapy is during drug preparation. So if you outsource drug preparation and you order each drug on prescription and it arrives in the closed system transfer device, then you can eliminate the major risk area in handling these drugs. Drug administration is the second most likely time that you could be exposed to the drug, and so if you're wearing all the personal protective equipment and you have a calm or sedated patient, that's and you're using a closed system transfer device, that's significantly reduced. And spill and waste management requires you to have the appropriate waste containers and to wear personal protective equipment. So as mentioned a few times, outsourcing cytotoxic drug preparation and sometimes administration, if your practice isn't set up for it, is a sensible idea. Otherwise, you need a cytotoxic drug safety cabinet, and you need to make sure that you're adhering with the local health and safety laws and regulations, because certainly there are more and more crackdowns and monitoring of veterinary practices to make sure that they're in line with what human facilities are doing. As I mentioned, a closed administration system, and they're needleless and with Luvelox syringes, they're specific systems. Personal protective equipment, a drug administration area that's quiet and restricting access to interruptions and other staff, and not crushing or splitting tablets is very important. All chemotherapy drugs should be stored in a spill-proof container that's clearly marked as cytotoxic, and they should be stored either in the fridge or the cupboard, depending on the agent. And the area should be lockable. They certainly shouldn't be stored anywhere that food or drink is kept. In order to limit the group of people that would be at highest risk if they were exposed accidentally to chemotherapy agents, it's recommended that people who are immune compromised, trying to conceive, pregnant, or breastfeeding shouldn't be involved in chemotherapy administration. And I also talk to pet owners and about these risks and advise them that it's incredibly important that they don't have contact with urine and feces, and minimize saliva contact as well with their pet, particularly if they're a child, they have children, or they're about to have a child, or they're breastfeeding or trying to conceive, and that applies for everyone, but particularly those at-risk populations. We know that there definitely are small amounts of chemotherapy metabolites in the blood and excreta of patients receiving chemotherapy, because there's a few studies that have shown that they're definitely there, but we know they're in really small amounts, and we don't know yet if those small amounts have the ability to damage cells. But until we know, because there's a theoretical likelihood that they could damage cells, it makes sense to take precautions. Spill kits can be purchased or prepared in the clinic. If there is a spill, it's very important not to aerosolize the drug. So, if the first thing to do if there's a spill is to ask for help, tell people there's been a spill, but don't try not to leave the area so that you can place a sign, limit access to the area, and then make sure you're wearing protective clothing, soak up liquid spills with incontinence pads so you're not aerosolizing the drugs. If it's powder, moisten paper towel, dab the area, flood the area copiously with disinfectant, scrub it, rinse, and repeat. With chemotherapy, we've spoken about the expected adverse effects, gastrointestinal, bone marrow, and hair side effects. Also, drug-specific potential adverse effects like sterile hemorrhagic cystitis. We've talked about the possibilities of errors in calculating drug doses or in administering treatment, and the patient factors that are important, really primarily a calm, quiet patient. We've spoken about metronomic chemotherapy and tyrosine kinase inhibitors and health and safety. So we've covered quite a lot. It's been a bit quick and it's hard to cover absolutely everything, but I hope that gives you a good introduction to chemotherapy. And if you have any questions, please feel free to let me know.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Shasta for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.